Okay, fellas, let me start. Let me talk about myself first. My name's Stephen Roberts, and I'm British, you can tell by the accent. Well, actually, I'm not. I'm an Australian. I went to Australia 30 years ago and became an Australian citizen. There's a small operation required, and I've had that. I've drunk the beer, got the hat with the corks on it, you know. G'day. And I had various jobs, one of which was at GCHQ in Britain, which is the same as NSA here. And I worked at the same place in Australia, but I liked Australia, so I wanted to stay on, which meant getting another job, basically, for bureaucratic reasons. So I got in with a bank, and I've now got my own consultancy, verifying the security devices used by banks, and I've done okay at that. And I'm just retired, in fact, so I'm quite... This is my first Dragon Con. I'm trying to get a life after work. It's damn good, I can say. It's really totally amazing. Anyway, there's a lot of horrors that happen within the banks that they hush up. I don't know about half of them myself, but there's quite a few weaknesses that are still there. And I think that the time is right to actually reveal a few of the weaknesses that are there. There's a lot more, which I might speak about next year. But I can cover in this talk how the PIN numbers are made, how the transactions, how your money is safeguarded, how your PIN is safeguarded, squash a few legends and expose a few things, tell a few stories. One thing you have to realise is with a bank's like a reservoir of money. Money comes in and money goes out, and the money held by individuals doesn't even feature in this great flushing of funds. Your account and your grandmother's account, unless you're a multimillionaire, it would just about be a pip on the horizon. Banks deal with large companies, you know, steel making companies, iron ore sales, agriculture, oil, you know, and there's a lot of money goes in and out. And there are clerks in the bank whose job it is to write checks and make SWIFT transactions. SWIFT is an interchange system between the banks. And this bit of paper arrives on some guy's desk. It says, write a check for $50 million for this. And he types it in, boom, off it goes, $50 million. Now, there is, in fact, another check on this. Actually, somebody else has to also do the same transaction. So he can't actually just help himself to the money. But if he could, it's only like an hour or so for all the funds in the bank. And I'm talking about not the branch bank, but the banking group, you know, the First Data Limited or whatever. All the funds flush through in about an hour. They all flush out and they all flush in again, and the balance is roughly equal. So if you could just divert that pipeline to your own account, you could steal the whole lot, you know, thousands of millions of dollars. Of course, getting out of the bank would be some trouble. If the front up and last with in cash. Actually, there are practical things in that. And concerning security, I was at some lecture on security, and some twat was saying a quarter of the people are totally honest all the time, and a quarter of the people are totally bent and would steal from the charity shop, and half the people are totally honest but can be subverted. So I put the paw up at the back and said, wrong, you know, a quarter of bent, three quarters can be perverted. And he said, well, explain it. So anybody can be blackmailed or held to ransom or whatever. They can ransom your family or offer you enough money. You know, everybody has a price. And the speaker said, well, what's your price, Steve? And I said, well, right now about 10 million, what's yours? You know? And I mean, there is a price at which you would start committing crimes. However saintly you think you are, you know, if you had $100 million, think of all the good you could do giving it to charities. You know, there's always some excuse for, you know, having a lot of money. Now, actually, for criminal purposes, it doesn't analyse very well, because you have to flee and live in hiding the rest of your life, basically, if you stole it from a bank, because they'd find it. Wherever the money went, they'd find it. And you've got to finance that lifestyle, and you've got to have, you know, fun when you've done it, or it's not worth doing. So, and they've only got to bribe various people to keep quiet about it, which is extremely difficult. To collaborate with anybody is very hard, so the price is actually quite high. But there is still a price, you know, where everybody would say, ooh, okay, I've been honest so far, but now I'm just going to grab the lot. For which reason, in fact, no one person is ever put in that position by a bank where they actually could nick all the money. You have to have several people on side. So my talk is called Banking Codes and Practical Weaknesses, but there's an alternative title, is Llama Farming for You. Right? These are llamas. May I recommend Bolivia and, you know, certain South American countries, the Pampas, the glorious plains, you know, the llama, oh, they're so friendly, which is what you're going to end up doing if you steal the money. Right, let's start off. Cryptography, wonderful stuff, cryptography. The making of codes and ciphers, and Ilonka Dunin is giving some wonderful talks here. She's a real the cryptographer's cryptographer. You know, her heart's in it. She's good. It's simple stuff actually, but you just have to have it go about it the right way. Cryptography makes things secret. It can achieve four things, like confidentiality. It can stop, you know, keep your messages confidential and stop people reading them. Integrity means that the message arrives in one piece and is not mangled or garbled or chopped short. You can ensure that with cryptography. You can encipher it in such a way that there's a code I'll show later on for doing that. Oh, here comes the beer. That's excellent. No. I'm going to get a whole podium. Look at this. The third thing is authenticity or authentication, which is a way of ensuring that the message really came from the person you think sent it. So I'm Steve Roberts, for example. If you get a message signed Steve Roberts, did that really come from me or did somebody else send it? And cryptography can ensure that. These three, of course, have the initial CIA, that's how I remembered them. Confidentiality, integrity, and authentication. And they recently discovered there's actually a fourth attribute, only noticed about 5 years ago, which is non-repudiation, which is that with the correct use of cryptography, I can be prevented from denying that I sent a message. Like if I send you a message and say, I owe you $100, then later on I can deny sending that. I can say, you made that message up. But with the use of cryptography, I can be held to, I can be proved to have sent that message and nobody else could have sent it. And this is actually very handy in banking when you want to send stuff up and down. In fact, it's hardly ever used for confidentiality. PIN numbers are confidential. That's about all there is. Integrity is a big deal because the amount of money is one of the things covered by that. Authentication is fairly important. Non-repudiation is very important in banking. And now this is going to be pretty heavy, so bear with me and I'll try and churn through it. There are three types of cipher. There's symmetric ciphers. And DES is the one you might have heard of, DES, Data Encryption Standard, invented in 1974, and it's got a 64-bit key, and it'll translate 64 bits of plain text into 64 bits of ciphertext. We write that algebraically as Z, the cipher is EK brackets D, E is the encryption operation, K is the key, and D is the data. And the decryption operation is a small d. So if I send you a message, I do the first of those equations and make Z. If you receive it, you apply that second equation to Z and you get D back. And we both have to know the key. We use the identical key. In fact, the encryption and decryption operations are also nearly identical. So this is quite cute, but it's out of date and leads to some horror stories, which I'll show you later. The second sort is asymmetric. RSA is the most common of these. Rivesh Shamir and Edelman, who invented it in 1977. I'll tell you a story about that later on, about the squeamish ossifrage. Nowadays, RSA keys are 1,024 bits long, and the key length is variable, and the longer the key, the more secure it is. And there's two keys with RSA, a secret and a public key. If you're talking about me, only I know my secret key. Nobody else ever finds it out, and everybody knows my public key. You all do, the world does, it's on the internet. And the two keys are related with a one-way process, so you can't work out my secret key if you've got my public key. And you can decipher with either one. You can make the first Z by using the public key, and then you apply the secret key to sort it out. Or you can decipher with a secret key, which makes a message that everybody can read, which actually does have a use for authentication. And you apply the second equation to sort it out. RSA is used. It's used by SSL when you make an internet session. There's an SSL key exchange which has RSA in it, which sends off your key to, you know, to the internet basically, and you can get an enciphered session. It's done automatically, and luckily it's done fairly well. So if you whack in card numbers and the like on the internet, they're actually pretty safe. There should be an enciphered session end to end, and the browser should warn you if there's not. Now the third sort are called hash codes. It's not really enciphering, but it is a cipher process where you take a message of any length. There's actually no key. Everybody has the same algorithm everywhere in the world, and you take a message of any length. It can be millions of bytes, and you boil it down to 160-bit digest. And there's several algorithms. MD5 is now broken. SHA-1 is a bit dicky. That was a US government cipher, SHA-1. SHA-0 was faulty. And there's now a competition going to find a better cipher because these are actually known to be faulty. And there's an open competition. You can write off to, is it NSA? NIST, N-I-S-T, National Institute of Standards and Technology. You can write off with your own algorithm now and get it adopted or into the competition to find these ciphers. And in 2011, there'll be an open assessment of the algorithms submitted. This, in fact, is how the successor to DES was found. It's called AES, Advanced Encryption Standard. And there were 15 candidate algorithms. It was boiled down to 5 good ones. And one was chosen to be AES, but the other 4 were equally good. It was a very, very nice decision. The first 10 were appalling, and the viciousness of the community. The 15 proponents of these things had 15 minutes to present their cipher to an audience of each other. It's a bigger audience than this, I would say, a few hundred people, but the world's best cryptographers. And one of the ciphers was cracked during the presentation. This guy was lecturing on it, and some German said, but if you put this here and that there, it all falls apart. So you imagine the mental caliber of these guys. And believe me, they are vicious. This is just science. When you invent a cipher, you're making a scientific statement. It's going to have to withstand the rigors of scientific analysis, which includes everybody attacking it. And you're saying, well, tell me why it's bad. Show me where it's weak. And if they can't do it, it might survive. DES is pretty good, AES is good, RSA, there's lots of attacks, but you make the key longer to get away from that. But these hash codes have all fallen. MD5 is thought to be safe and it's not, and SHA-1 is a bit iffy and it's not good enough. And so somebody actually did say, I've invented a new hash code and it should be good for 10 years. And again, some of the audience said, hey, that is longer than we've ever gone before. So codes are meant to be safer, decades. It's a property of all codes, of all these three. Every single bit of the output is munged around by every single bit of the input. So if you take, 10 billion characters and you change the first one from an A to a B, or any of them from an A to a B, the whole hash code will be different. Every bit of the hash code will be different, or the two respective ciphers. So that was the technical bit. Now let's have some fun. Let's... Oh, those good old days for you, any steampunks in the audience. Well, let's go and rob a branch bank. Those llamas are beckoning. I'm going to go and rob the bank. Well, stick them up. This is a bad idea. You actually can't get good video of a bank robbery. You can get security cameras, but not good pictures. This is a very bad idea. For a start, the bank hasn't got any money in it. They've got about 15,000 worth of cash in the bank, which is the most you can steal because it's all they've got. And it's very likely you'll be caught. They shut the door. The people, the police come. They're so unsporting. But it's very likely you'll be sent to jail for typically 3 years. And everybody gets very upset. The victims, the teller, the public in there are traumatised and can sue you. It's a bad idea all around. People still do it. And God knows, must be desperate. Much smarter thing, let's rob a bank electronically. Here's my home computer. This is my wife. This is, for a start, you can choose how much you want. Do you want 10 million or 100 million or how much money do you want? You can choose the amount if you know where to go to change ciphers to get it. Then it's unlikely you'll be caught. I mean, getting the money out is a problem, as I said earlier, but if the bank catches you fiddling with their ciphers and codes, it's unlikely they'll catch you, actually. They'll probably turn off the attack. They'll never know who did it. If you are caught, you probably won't get punished. The bank will just say, well, don't do it again and run along. And the bank doesn't want a big scandal, of how they got, how vulnerable they were to an attack. And there were no human victims. So you could say in court, who's the victim? So I stole 100 million from, XYZ bank. But who have I traumatized? Where's my victim? And the victimness is spread across all the account holders of the bank and all the shareholders. But then you see, I don't know how it is here, but in Australia, we've got 4 major banks and they all make enormous profits. Enough for $1,000 for every man, woman and child in Australia every year. And that's each bank. it's obscene, you know. So if you stand up in court and say, well, the bank has lots of money, I just wanted some of it, the judge will sympathise with you. And, well, the media certainly will, you know, big bad bank attacked by poor starving, you know, hobo. So there are no human victims, so you can be Mr. Nice Guy. Oh, I wouldn't have hurt anybody. Get away with it. So that's where it's at. Now, I'll come to the plastic cars now. Everybody's got one of these. Lots of stuff on the card. There's a primary account number, which is that 16-digit number embossed across the middle of the card. And they emboss it in such a way that it goes on to the logo, that silver logo at the end, which is a hologram these days. That's actually embossed out by the number. So because it's an attack where you iron the card flat and emboss a new number on it, it used to be easy to do that. The signature's on the back of the card, obviously, you've signed it yourself. And there's a silly little number on the back, a 3-digit number on the back. I don't know if you have that here, but we certainly do. That number, which all further identifies it. And what I'd advise you to do is to learn that number and scratch it off the card, because anybody who sees your card is going to see that number. So if he knows your card 16-digit number and that 3-digit number, you know, he can pose as you over the phone. Nobody else really needs to know it except you. Now, in the magnetic stripe, on the back of the card, there's a magnetic stripe. Some cards are smart cards as well. I won't go into that, but the technology, the use of that is actually primitive. But on the mag stripe, there are three tracks, and one contains your name and address and not much else. The track two is the big one. It contains the PAN, which is that 16-digit number, the card expiry date, a service code, and a bit of other data. And the other data includes the CVV and PVV, which are values that confirm the card and confirm the PIN using secret keys.
Hack is on this side.
The voice.
You got a dart now.
And, there's a legend that the PIN number is on the card. I can assure you it's not. The PVV looks like a PIN number, but it's a different number. I can assure you, and really assure you, that the PIN number is not on the card. Because, I'll come to that later, the PIN is your signature. It has to count as your signature. And the banks go to an enormous length to keep it safe. Nobody in the bank knows what the PIN is, or even can know what the PIN is. Otherwise, you could say, well, somebody else used my PIN, so the bank has to make sure you can't say that. There's two methods of making PINs. There's one which is truly terrible and one which is quite good. IBM 3624 was the name of an ATM machine years ago. It was built like a battleship. It's an enormous sheet steel thing, totally indestructible. And that makes a PIN called a natural PIN, which I'll come to soon. And Visa invented a method, which is called Visa method, but used by everybody, a far better method for making a PVV from a PIN, and they use the PVV for checking. I'll come to these later. With both those methods, you can still choose your own PIN. For the IBM method, they record the difference between your PIN and the natural PIN. The Visa method starts with the PIN number, and you can choose, it doesn't address where that number comes from. And to get the PIN to the customer, either the customer has to come into the branch and select it there and then on the equipment the bank provides, or they choose it for you and bang you a mailer in the post, which is a process fraught with difficulty. When I worked for the bank, I spent at least half my time making sure that I could say this, that no employee of the bank is or ever was or will be able to see or to find out any part of anybody's PIN. And I have to be able to say this in court when grilled by the best QC in Australia, who will say, you know, I put it to you, you are lying. And I'll say, no, nobody can see the PIN. You know? And this means, you know, this includes all the employees we've ever had, the ones who've left, and all the employees the bank's going to get. And any part of the PIN means even one bit of the PIN. It's a 4-digit number. It's about 13 bits binary. And this also includes PINs of other banks, because other banks' cards go through my bank's equipment, so their PINs are guarded by this too. This also includes old PINs that have long since fallen out of use, and reissued PINs where they've forgotten the PIN, and future PINs if they come in tomorrow and want to choose a PIN. So this is still true against every possible adversity. And it's a feature in key breaking. You assume all the bad things when you break codes. You assume when you design a code, you assume the attacker has the machine that you're going to build. You assume he can put plain text into it and get cipher out of it as much as he likes, an infinite amount. And it has to cost him a certain amount of money to break the code. And when you spend that much money, which is it was $10 million in 1982, it's index-linked, when you spent that, that should give no help at all in breaking a second message. And this has to be true 30 years into the future for military codes. You're looking at the computers of 2039 costing whatever $10 million in 1982 is worth in 2039. It's a difficult business. And we make all these assumptions so that the code is robust. If you say, well, that's true except for past customers who've left the bank, you know, well, that's not true anymore then. And they can sue the bank. The PIN generation, the IBM 3624 method is the worst idea ever. Going back to the DES algorithm, you have this secret DES key called KPG, and you encipher the PAN number with it. The PAN number is 16 digits, it'll fit into 64 bits, and you encipher it, and then you decimalize the result by applying a decimalization table to it, because the result comes out in hexadecimal. So you have this table which is 16 decimal digits long. So if you get an A or an F in your result, you look it up in this table, it gives you a decimal number. And the first four digits are the PIN. So far, so good, but if you want to change KPG, if you get neurotic that the PIN key is getting a bit old and maybe people know it, you've got to reissue the entire card base. And worse still, if an attacker finds KPG, he can reissue it. He wouldn't reissue this. I'll show you how to do this in a minute. Another interlude. This is the machine that makes PIN mailers and envelopes them, roughly. You put in at the end some data, it'll print the PIN mailers, also emboss the card, put them into two separate envelopes and dump them into two bins for mailing. And the thing to do is to get a job in the mailer room where this is used. My bank actually caught somebody planted by organised crime in the mailer room who got that job for this purpose. And when you're in there, you can do lots of horrors. You can, well, for a start, you can copy the spool file for the printer, which has clear PIN numbers in it. You can pretend the mailers have got screwed up and repeat the print run, and nobody except you finds out if you do that right. You can look in the trash can for mailers that were screwed up, and hopefully there shouldn't be any, but there might be, and they do get shredded, but before they get shredded, they're stealable. And you can put your own PIN numbers into the stream. You can make up a I've forgotten my PIN transaction and put it through the system and grab the PIN mailer at the end. Nobody knows. Well, actually, people do know. This is all dual controlled, so as I said, they have to keep the amount you can steal down to a certain level. Below that, it's not protected. So I could, when I worked in the bank, I could have nicked, you know, $20,000 or something, but I had a paid job there. It's not worth it, so I'm not going to do that. But to nick a worthwhile amount, to nick $50 million, I couldn't do it on my own. So here's the thing you can do. You ring the bank up and say, I'm Joe Bloggs, the man next door. I've forgotten my PIN, and the bank will send you a mailer with a PIN in it, and you get round to Joe Bloggs' mailbox before he does and steal the mailer. And poor Joe never knows anything about this, except you've now got his PIN number. So, I mean, the bank will have to get you to identify yourself. That's the defence they have in place now, but it didn't used to be there. Another attack, the PIN to recover KPG, and this is now cryptographically feasible. You open a few bank accounts, more than one, but a couple of dozen maybe, and they'll give you lots of PIN numbers, one for each account, and lots of cards. And you try, you can guess what a decimalization table is. You can try that those figures there, which are the sort of minimal case, but people use better ones than that, luckily. And you guess what KPG is, which means you have to exhaust 2 to the power 56 keys, but that is now doable at amateur cost, thanks to the Electronic Frontier Foundation, who did it. 11 years ago they did it, you know, in a garage. And that was 11 years ago, now we're in 2009. So you try all the possible values of KPG and see if all the PINs come out right. And if you have enough accounts, with one account you get lots of answers, of which one would be the correct answer. With many accounts, you'll get the accurate KPG. And once you've got KPG, you can generate PINs for every card in the card base. So once you know a card number, you can get the PIN for it and then go and use it as an ATM, and the card holder will get blamed because the bank goes to this length to show that only he knew the PIN, in theory. So we go to the Visa method, which was invented in the 1980s and is far better. This uses two keys, two DES keys, called the left and right keys, and the customer chooses any pin he likes, or the bank can assign one, or in the worst case, the bank can make one with the previous method, which is a very bad idea. And you apply this mess to it. You have the pin and the pan and the expiry date mashed up in some data, and moving out from the middle of the brackets. You encipher it with the left key, decipher it with the right key, and then cipher it with the left key. And then you pick through the result of that, picking out decimal digits. And if there aren't four of them, there's a trick to make some more. And that's the pin verification value. And this is obviously a one-way process because you don't know the keys. So when the pin gets entered, the bank does know those keys and checks it. Is that on the slide? Yeah, the PBVs, we call it on the card. So when you use the card and the pin, the pin that you entered, which might be the right pin or might not, and the PBV from the card go off to the bank, and the bank can tell whether or not that pin matches that PBV. They can only tell in a yes or no way. They can't say if it's one out or anything like that. This is far more secure, and there's no real attack on this, because you've got to recover two DES keys now, not one DES key to crack that. And also the bank can change the keys. In a brilliant bit of foresight, there's an indicator on the card, and there's actually six values. There's a number 1 to 6 on the card, and the bank can change KL and KR any time they like and increase this number. So if the keys get a bit dodgy, they can make new ones and not have to replace the card base. Which actually means when you get a new card after 3 years, the PBV will be different. It'll be the same pin, but the PBV will be different on the card. Pin entry. Pin entry is an ATM. What happens? I'll go through this because it's cryptographically interesting. The pin gets enciphered actually in the keyboard of the ATM. What my company does is check that the ATM keyboards and handheld pin entry devices are safe for you and your grandmother's pin, and we have to think of all possible attacks on them and demonstrate that it costs a certain amount of money to attack it. It used to be $150,000, but now there's a sort of point scale that you have to score 25 points on this very difficult scale, and basically it has to take roughly a week with somebody highly skilled doing a very delicate attack. So in the ATM, an old ATM had a computer in the bottom, and the clear pin would flush all over the ATM in the wiring and finally come into this computer where it would get enciphered by software. It was very, very bad. Modern ATMs have a secure pin pad in the keyboard, so the circuit board that has the copper footings that you type your pin number on, that circuit board has the enciphering chip on it. And it's usually in a potted module, so you can't access it. And the pin gets enciphered right there and then inside the very circuit board you entered it on. Once the pin's enciphered, it's safe. So there's a key called pin encryption key, KPE. People like to start keys with K. Now the bank that owns the ATM knows what KPE is. By saying it knows what KPE is, actually no person in the bank knows one bit of any key, like the pin numbers. They have a box called a security control module, and I've got one there. That's one made by a company called Encipher. That's a security control module. It costs about $40,000. It's basically a 386 PC, but it is highly secure. It's got booby traps and stuff inside that you never believe, and you can store keys safely, and you can take it home and open it with a tin opener, and you'd never get the keys out of it. The keys are internally enciphered and so on. So it basically behaves to the world like a black box. You can send in pin numbers enciphered under KPE. You also send in KPE enciphered under some other keys and some more keys above that. And the box will say good pin or bad pin. And it's guaranteed not to say, well, the pin is this. So the security control module effectively knows all these keys, but only inside the box. So no human being knows the keys. So basically the bank through this box knows what KPE is, so they the enciphered pin goes into the box and the box says good or bad. No human being is in that process. I'll come to key loading later on. There's some hugely funny stories about it. Pin tapping, here they go. That's an ATM in India with a whole crowd there, and the guy in the blue shirt can see what the entered pin is if you look carefully at the photographs. There's so many people in India that there's always a crowd like that. Once the pin gets enciphered, it's pretty safe, like I said, but before it gets enciphered, it's not safe, and it's your fault because you're entering the pin. and the bank has to provide safe equipment and a chance to get privacy. So that booth wouldn't really do. But shoulder surfing, you stand right behind somebody, you look over his shoulder. The etiquette now, certainly in Australia, is that you can't do that. You've got to stand a metre behind, and people do behave pretty well like that. Cameras pointing at the keyboard. It's a camera now is the size of a fingernail, and you can get one on a chip and just stick it on in the recess, just stick it up in there, and it can film the keyboard. Or you can mount one in where these two guys are, the shop awning above them, you mount one on the back of that. And it's mounted in the ceiling looking at the ATM. And there's a row about this because the bank will say, well, it's not our fault, we provide the ATM, that's safe, and it's up to the merchant to provide a safe environment. And the merchant will say, well, I don't know, I'm just running the shop, you know, what people stick under my awning is beyond my control. And the poor customer says, well, it's certainly not my fault, I'm entering my PIN in privacy. So there's a bit of a ruckus about whose fault it is if PINs get filmed. Another attack on the ATM, which is easy to do if you can get the front off, not where the cash is, but where the plumbing and the computer is. You just unscrew the keyboard and bring it down a couple of inches and put another keyboard on top of it. Then you can copy the PINs as they go through. And for that reason, in fact, the keyboards are now detecting, so they detect when they've been unscrewed. So it's a bigger attack. You could actually mount a whole false surface over it, and it's been done. You make the entire surface yourself with the false thing in it, and you fit that in. Now the whole surface is about an inch higher that you're copying the PINs. It was actually done in Germany in 1985, and there's an instructive case. The guy got $1.5 million at the time, which was a lot, from doing it. But he turned himself into police because he said, well, the bad guys came after me, you know, to keep paying people off, and I've only got a couple hundred thousand left, and, you know, my life is very difficult. So he turned himself in. So, you know, $1.5 million will not get you very far when the bad guys realise you've got it, you know. The PAN number, to use the PIN, you've got to have the PAN number, the card number. That's easy to get. When you swipe your card in the machine, you know, the teller drops it. Whoops, and on the way up, gets swiped in another machine under here. You can buy the card swipe in a hobby electronic shop, Fry's, I think they're called. Or you just look at it, you just press it down on soap, or if you've got a mind like me, you just remember the number. It's only 16 digits. I can do 16. Well, if there's money in it, I can do 16. Yeah, and also the card PAN might be on the receipt. They've actually stopped printing the whole number on the receipt now, but the ATM receipt or the cash receipt, which people throw away, has got part of the card number on it. Nowadays, not enough to actually copy, but it was easy to get. Oh, sorry, I'll go back up. Whoops. This one here, the gadget at the bottom, that's a handheld PIN pad. It's actually on a stand. So you can't hand hold it. They put a security shield on it, and the invention where the hand comes in, it's like a lens that comes down over it and magnifies the keyboard and provides privacy. It's a bit like the cone of silence in Get Smart, but the stand itself has to prevent looking, especially looking by the shop girl, because the shop girl can see everything, and if that stand didn't have those black ears, the girl would just about from there be able to see the PIN. But usually in a shop, it's very easy for the assistant to see the PIN. So in fact, the main assailant against PIN tapping is actually the main assailant is the shop employee. And when PIN pads are tampered with, the main suspect is usually the owner of the shop. It's not a question of bad guys getting in and doing it. It's a question of the owner of the shop thinking, well, trade's a bit thin, I'll rob some PIN numbers. But nobody can detect it because he owns the shop, and you know, he can be there after hours and so on. The keys in an ATM, I won't go into exactly how RSA keys work, but you can sign by using the secret key, you can sign a key with a higher authority. So the ATM starts off with three levels of RSA key. The manufacturer puts one in there, the public key only, he keeps the secret key himself. The ATM itself has a pair of RSA keys, which it's supposed to make, but actually they're injected, but it's as if it made them. So there's an RSA pair in the ATM. The SK never leaves the ATM. And then finally, there's a public key of the bank, which was introduced under the manufacturer's authority. And whoever knows a secret key of the bank can control the ATM. So that PK bank is called the controlling PK. And the bank drives everything. Anything not signed with the bank's secret key, which the ATM verifies, the ATM will ignore. So this is so far so good, but we need to get a key and decipher some PIN numbers. So what happens next? the bank rings up and says hello, actually sends something signed by SK Bank, so you can't do it from home. The ATM sends to the bank, makes a new DES key called KI, a brand new key. It signs it with its own secret key and then ciphers it with the public key of the bank. And believe me, when the bank gets this, they can apply the secret key bank and strip the outer layer off. Then they apply the public key of ATM, which they've also got from an earlier transaction, and strip that layer off, and end up with KI in the clear. In the clear, meaning inside the security control module. And then the bank, there's two sorts of bank in this. There's a sponsoring bank who own the ATM. There's actually an acquiring bank who are going to acquire the transactions. And for ATM, they're the same, but this works with FPOS as well. And in a pin pad, a handheld pin pad, you might get up to 8 entities who each think they own the pin pad. It can be a bank and an oil company and department store and so on. They each think it's their pin pad. And they all have their own keys, but above that is the sponsor level of keys that can create and destroy these people. So the bank has to make an acquirer key, KIA, which is a function of KI and the acquirer code, and give it to the acquirer. And that's usually a weak spot in the cryptography. But then all this lot happens, right? This is now wearing the acquirer hat, now with the oil company, if you like. You send it a transport key. The Australian one's called KEC1, key encrypting key number one. And there's a mechanism that rolls over every time you use it. And then you send a pin protect key under that. So you send KPP under KEC1, and KEC1 rolls over to a new value, and the bank rolls theirs over as well. Then you make the pin, the pin protect key is called that because it's not a key and doesn't protect pins, I will say. The pin encrypt key, which is going to encrypt the pin number, is a function of the pin protect key and the transaction serial number and the transaction amount. So you're going to get a different KPE for every transaction you do. And then finally, when you enter a PIN, it gets enciphered by KPE. But the next guy along has a different KPE. So if he's got the same PIN as you, you're going to get a different result. And this is important because if it was the same PIN all the time, you could try entering lots of PINs and monitor the cipher traffic coming from the ATM. And if one PIN matched what had gone before, then the underlying pins would also match. So there's actually 7 or 8 levels of keys in an ATM. It's fairly horrendous, but all this has a logical thing. Now, I better cover a bit about DES. It was invented in 1974, and for some reason, NSA said, 64 bits is very nice, you know, but you don't need 64 bits. You only need 56. I don't want to go into why they said that. You know. In 1974 was a long time ago. I mean, the Apollo space program, which was a couple of years before that, the computers on that had a less computer power than in a wristwatch. Actually, less than there is on your home toaster. Things were primitive in 1974, and people thought 256 is a lot. Well, now, because of Moore's law, everything doubles every 18 months. It's not a lot anymore. So in 1980s, people were starting to get neurotic. And in 1993, somebody actually published plans for how to make a DES breaker. There was an academic paper by Vina, who said this is how you can make a DES breaker for $1 million. And the banks ignored that. 1998, Paul Kocher and others in California actually wrote DES. They actually, of the people of the EFF, they actually set up shop in a garage. It cost $220,000, and they paid for it themselves out of their own pockets, and they built a DES cracker, which filled a garage, but actually cracked DES. And then the banks began to react. I remember I was there at the time, and I was going, and I got hold of the first book. First copy in Australia was rushing around with it, showing it to people, saying, here's how to break your codes. And, whoa, 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 what? That woke them up. By about 2001, people have distributed attacks going, so you actually don't do it in your garage, you do it in other people's garages, or you do it on other people's computers. And it's feasible. It's out there now. There are botnets out there now, which have some unknown purpose. But if you want to grab a few thousand computers for some purpose, you can implant a virus in them and use their computing power. Luckily, by 2001, the banks had begun to move to triple DES. Hadn't really got very far, but they'd begun. By 2005, mostly triple DES was in place with the banks. Triple DES is more secure, I'll come to it. And the banks were saying you can't use single DES anymore for new systems. However, you can. They're going to be moving by 2011. It'll all be gone. But right now, it's breakable for $10,000. and I know this because it's me that's making this offer. I will vake a DES key for $10,000. I want the 64 bits of plain text and the 64 bits of cipher text, and if I don't do it, you don't pay. All right, and I'm going to make a profit too. So it's, you know, 10 grand will get you the DES key vake. And I'm stirring up the banks about this because they need to get rid of the old DES devices. There is a successor for DES called Advanced Encryption Standard, which is better. It's 128 bits, and that's pretty good. The banks are still really conservative about it. So I'll tell you a story about what happened. They said, oh, triple DES, single DES could be double DES. Why don't we do one DES in cipher? Let's do another DES in cipherment and decipher the result with another key and get another cipher. This is actually only as secure as single DES. It gives you no more security at all. But the reason is there's a meet-in-the-middle attack. Because we assume all the bad things. You assume the attacker knows the last cipher and the original data. This is a reasonable assumption. So the attacker can make two lists. He can try K1 2 to the 56 times, make a list of Z1s, and then try K2 2 to the 56 times, make a list of Z1s that come that way. And it should be the same Z1. And making a list is cheap, even if it's 2 to the 56 long. So for twice 2 to the 56, which is 2 to the 57, you can vake this and recover both keys. So they said, curse, let's do triple DES, let's do another cipher and another encipherment and do three encipherments. Now you can't meet in the middle. You meet somewhere where K2 is. And the meet in the middle attack, you can do two exploits, two exhaustions rather than three. So it's 2 to the 112 secure, which is very, very secure. And luckily, K3 can be the same as K1, which means you've got two keys and you've got two key security. And finally, they made that middle step a decryption, not an encryption, because then it's compatible with single DES. If you look at the mess at the bottom, you start with D, you encipher it with a key, you decipher it with KR, but K1 is K2, which is actually the same key, so you end up back with D again, then you encipher it with KL. So this is called triple DES or two-key triple DES. Some virtuals push three-key triple DES, which is no more secure than two-key because of this. So we have a secure form of DES, but when they send the keys, you send a key under another key, you make a transport key, send a key under it. When you want to send a double length key, you have to send it in two pieces. So you make the first mess and the second mess, which only differ in the data content there. This is a real problem, because what an attacker can do there, the attacker can control the ciphertext that's fluttering around as well. He just repeats that first thing. Instead of sending the first and the second thing, you send the first thing and the first thing again, okay, and it'll decipher to a key which is KL with KL, not KLKR, but KLKL, which is now a single DES key. So without actually doing any triple DES attacks, you can recover triple DES keys if you can tamper with the traffic. And it's only this year, or last year actually, and in 2008 the banks woke up to that. So the solution is to bundle or package or envelop the keys, the same thing. You send the key in a package of data with headers on it and use bytes on it, and the whole thing gets enciphered together, and you can't swap KL and KR anymore if you do that. And that's coming in now. It will be better to use AES, just be done with single DES and 64-bit blocks, just use AES and 128-bit key, and you can never exhaust 2 to the 128. Now keys are safe and cipher by other keys, which is very good. But then, how do the other keys get in there? Oh, well, they're enciphered by still higher keys. Okay, so you end up the very top key of the hierarchy, which would have been KI in that RSA exchange, has to get in there in the clear. All the RSA keys have to get in there in the clear. So that's the same thing. So people have to type it in from paper. The key's on paper. They have to type it in on a keyboard. This is going to be done into a security control module, and I've been the manager of these sessions quite a lot. Somebody must have the clear key on paper, but the principle is that nobody can know even one bit of the key. What people used to do, they said, well, a key is like, a triple DES key is two keys, left and right key. So if Fred has the left key and Charlie has the right key, that's sort of dual custody. But actually it's not, because it means that Fred knows half the key, which is very, very bad. It's safe against me, but Fred or Charlie, you only have to do a single DES exhaustion to get the entire key. So how it's done, you make two full-length components and you XOR them together, and that makes the final key. So Fed starts with a 1, and you've got no idea what Charlie starts with. It could be 1 or 0. The result could be 1 or 0. So Fed knows exactly nothing about the final key. That's the first bit, and you go along the others. And this is the recognised way to do it. Now, the stories I've had, there's me and all these senior managers of the bank typing keys into the security control module, and as usual in life, things go wrong. And actually, the stories I've seen, I want to go through in the time I got left. We got there were cabling engineers, had the floor up, and we said, look, bugger off, we want to load key. And they said, we're working, you bugger off. You know? And that was a bit of a problem. We had a security control module that was a bit dicky, and the floor shook. It was the floor like this. And it shook, and as soon as we moved away from it, the thing tampered itself. We had to go back and load the keys again. The fire alarm goes off. It rained on some gear that caught fire. That was fun. We managed to keep going, but they say, we're going to close you down, but you can't close a bank down. It never stops. Security guards, this is a highly secure building. There's things in. It's so secure that the custodians can't get in. Have to be specially signed in. We forgot to sign one of them in. So the security guard said, well, you can't come in. So you sort of go and reason with him. Somebody turned up. The keys are kept in a safe with a metal key, and they forgot the metal key, but never mind, we got it open with a screwdriver. So there was a bit of a please explain after that as to how come, this could be open with a screwdriver. One custodian, one of my sessions, showed up without the key, but he left with the key when he left his building, and the key was in a taxi somewhere, so he was sort of go chasing around Melbourne, Australia, looking for taxis with yellow envelopes in them. So he went to Perth, which is the equivalent of Anchorage, Alaska, without the key, forgot the key, and rang me up from Perth and said, I'm in Perth, but I haven't got the key with me, and I thought, I can't tell him over the phone what the key is, He managed to get through it. I said, well, do you know Joe Blow's phone number, or the last 4 digits of that, and Fred's fax number, and how old am I, and put that, and we managed to build a key up over the phone. It was extraordinarily messy, but we did it. The keys went to the wrong security module. This security module does everything, so a bank only needs one of it, but supposing it fails, then there's no bank, so they have to have a spare. And it's so critical, in fact, they have to have 2 spares, so if one does conk out, they still haven't got a single point of failure. So a bank has to have 3 of these, plus you need the disaster recovery one, plus you need the year 2000 experimental one, plus you need one for development. And these boxes all look alike, so you can put the keys in the wrong one. That's fairly easy. So I made a procedure to test that you had the right module, and then we had a case where we tested the wrong one. We loaded the keys wrongly to the right module, so that was faulty. And we tested the wrong module, which worked fine, and we left, and things went in a heap. You get there's no keyboard. This is one of the biggest ever attacks. This is a laptop, but computers have a keyboard, and you get there and suddenly there's no keyboard there because things go walkabout, as we call it in Australia, and the keyboard's flown away somewhere, and you have to go and find a keyboard. And the easiest attack in the world is to get a keyboard and put bugs in it and leave it lying around this place where we enter the keys, and the bugs pick up what's typed. So you really should store the keyboard with the security control module. It's kept in a locked cabinet, and the keyboard stays in there, and nobody ever gets that keyboard out unless all the custodians are there, all the heavies are there. And you have to show it's not tapped, because the tapping device, again, is the size of the end of your finger, and you put it in the cable, copy all the keyboard tapper. The written keys, so they're written. I can't even write my own name, and other people can't write either, so you find that the key can't be read. You get a character, it could be a D or a 0 or a 6, or who knows what it is. And there are ways of checking it. Some more stories which are beautiful. There we were loading keys, and all these fat cats come in with the mayor of Melbourne and start showing around, saying, this is this, and this is this, and these are the custodians. And say, look, we're trying to work in privacy. Well, I'm the CEO of the bank, What are you going to do about it? So we just sort of just stand around and look efficient until they shoved off, and then load the keys. It's common to burn the papers. You load the key off paper, you make a sort of single disposable copy, then you set fire to it. But you can't do it indoors, so the alarms all go off, so you have to go outside. And we went outside, it was midnight, we went outside, and of course nobody smoked, so we just sort of wait for somebody to come along, which doesn't happen very often in Melbourne because it's a bit of a ghost town, and say, have you got a light? And eventually we found somebody who had a light, but of course we didn't have a cigarette, so I've got a light, you know, and he's expecting you to manifest a cigarette, but nobody had one, so you have to explain, we have one of the little blaze of papers here. Very strange. There were like four of us, you know, it's not enough to attract attention, and four blokes have cost one, so have you got a light, we haven't got any cigarettes. And this is my favourite story. It was a ceiling like this, and the flaming technician was up there fiddling with the air conditioning, and there we were loading keys on this keyboard, and that tile slid aside, and this technician appeared like God in his high heaven, surveying the mortals beneath, and the keyboard in particular. Oh dear. The fun I've had. Things always go wrong. You're just only there to actually manage, you know, make sure the session works. Now, about integrity. This is where you're using keys for authentication and integrity. I should have put both there. Message authentication code. You go along the message, enciphering it block by block, and you XOR each block with the next one when you encipher it. So every block munges what happens after that. So when you get the final result, everything in the message has been munged into that. And you take half that as a 32-bit message authentication code. You send the message in the clear with the MAC at the end. This is what an ATM sends when you're at the bank. And the receiving end repeats the MAC calculation. It uses a secret DES key. And if it gets the same answer, then that shows he's got the same message. But if the answer's different, then you can't tell what happened, but something happened. And that's the answer rejecting the message. So the ATM says to the bank, it says, look, Stephen Roberts is here. Well, actually, Steve Roberts' card is here. Who knows who it is? And this is the PIN number that was entered. And this is the amount of money he wants. And the bank goes hum and haw. The bank's security control module verifies the PIN, looks in the account, sees if it's got that much money, and debits the account, if it has, and sends back, say, yeah, the PIN's right. He had the money. We've taken it out of the account. So now the ATM owes him $100. So spit out $100 worth of bills. Now, right, these have message authentication codes on them, so you can't alter the message, or at least they're supposed to, but not all banks do this, right? Some banks send these messages in the clear with no authentication code, which means you can alter it. You can capture the message and alter the first one, say he wants $10, and the bank say, yeah, and then the return message can say $10,000, and the ATM will just believe it, and you can make the ATM jackpot, it's called. You can spit out any amount of money. And believe me, I've seen this. Now, I've seen lots of things. You know, I've seen the Aardvark roaming the veldt and the Hanging Gardens, well, the Pyramids of the Nile at least, and lots of things. I've had tea in the Reichstag, I've had dinner in the Kremlin. But to see an ATM vomit out its entire contents, which is $500,000, you know, and it just, I dream for weeks after this, you know. It's like the pot of porridge that boils over and never stops, you know. Because the ATM just keeps winding money out, it goes all over the floor. A wonderful spectacle, I can tell you. So how do you attack the bank? Well, the easy way is to exhaust single DES. It's 10 grand and I can do it for you. I do have moral standards, actually. I need to know a bit about what's going on, but it can be done. The key verification code, when they check keys, they actually encipher zero with the key and keep 24 bits of it, and you can't recover the key from the 24 bits, but you can use it to check if you've exhausted the key. We haven't yet developed a method of doing that. It would be good to store all the possible keys, and I've worked through this. It's 4,000 or 5,000 terabytes, which is quite a lot. That'll store all the possible DES keys in order. If you wanted to store just an index bit for each one, it's 1/56 of that, which is only about 9,000 terabytes, or 9 petabytes. But 9,000 terabytes is not that much anymore. You know, you can get a 1 terabyte's $109 in Walmart, and that's if you just buy one of it at Walmart. If you've got to deal with the manufacturer, it's probably about $1. So it's starting to get worth it. And also, there are ways of cheating. You can reduce the data by a factor of 8 at least when you store these. Other attacks are factoring RSA and misusing the data structure under RSA, which I'll come to, because this is scary. Yves Shamir and Edelman, I hate RSA with a vengeance because it's got so many ways of being attacked. So on a black day in a black month at the black bottom of the sea in 1977, these wretched people invented RSA. Actually, it was invented by a mate of mine at GCHQ before that, and we threw it away because we didn't like it. And they published it in Scientific American, and they made a very rash thing. They said this would be safe for 40,000 trillion years. Now, I've got a bit of advice here. Don't make predictions, especially about the future. 40,000 trillion years, 17 years later, it was broken. 17 years. And it was broken in February 1994. And in December 1994, I met the guy who did it. And I said, oh, you broke RSA. He said, oh, I wouldn't do it that way now. You know, he found a better way across the month of 1994. And year by year, because of Moore's law, we're breaking bigger and bigger RSA keys. It's up to about 640 now. It's expensive to break, I mean, beyond amateur reach, but it can be done by a government, say. This is very nice, except that the banks are still stuck on 512 bits. All the Australian banks are, anyway. They are coming now to 1,024 bits, and there are schemes that go above 1,024. So 1024 bit is now common, I'd say mandatory, and the chance to expand to 2048 is mandatory in a new system. But 512 bit RSA is still out there. One bank I know uses even less. So this is factorable. So what of the future? Now I'm going to make predictions about the future. Where we're at now. There were de facto banking standards issued in 2004 by Visa and MasterCard. I mean, the banks had their own standard, which everybody ignored, including the banks themselves. But Visa and MasterCard put their feet, they actually collaborated in a wonderful collaboration, because they're deadly enemies normally, commercial enemies. But the two security guys got their heads together and said, right, we're going to make a worldwide standard which everybody has to come to, or you can't play in the Visa and MasterCard world, which does affect the banks, so this does bite. And they made a good standard, they made a standard in 2004, but they let the old standard go on until 2008, basically. So 1st of April 2008, and I beg with them not to choose that date, but they did. 1st of April last year, the vicious standard cut in, and you can't go to the old standard anymore. So if you make an ATM now or a PIN device, there's now a decent standard which it's got to be secure to. Before that, there wasn't. I think things leak out. And some devices have been attacked, and PIN pads actually have been attacked and been recovered with tapping bugs in them. And more scary, it's happened at least four times, and the first tapping bug was awfully badly made. You know, you'd fail it for a year 12 school project, too scruffy. But one attack had a very nice, well-made card in it with a mobile phone attached, or a mobile phone chip. Highly professionally made, highly professionally laid out. You can tell, you know, a student circuit board from a professional circuit board. So single days we're stuck with until next year, the year after. The old PIN pads, you can't sell them anymore, but they're still in use, and they're going to hang around until 2014. And we don't really know what will happen then. But there should be some initiative by then to say, you know, this is secure to the higher Visa standard, you can advertise this. They want a little tick they can put on them, that sort of thing. Cryptography is still not quite right. Most of it is good in most places. It really should be end-to-end. I mean, the keyboard you type on and the security control module at the bank should have keys, and everything else is a node in the system. We haven't quite got to that phase yet. But it's possible to get it. I reckon about 2018 it'll be possible to get that, because it requires a few practices to be changed. Actually, some of the building blocks aren't even there yet. You know, about wrapping keys, for example, as a way of wrapping keys that's been mandated, which turns out to be faulty. So we're still fashing around on that. And I'm not real happy with the way things are. And then they've got to catch on. So it might be sort of 2020 before cryptography is totally rigorous. Cryptography is still the harder way to attack. It's easier to fiddle with the protocols or make deceptive practices or get a job inside the bank or hold up the armoured car. Actually, I said you can't rob a branch bank, you can rob an armoured car. They contain some millions of dollars, but of course they're protected against that. And the merchants, there's a lot of shonky practice with the merchants keeping your card number, and they could use that to defraud. But there's a security standard now in place that they'll be held to, in theory now, but in practice by 2012, that they can't store your card number. They can store it during the transaction, then they've got to lose it. And that would be welcome. Again, my company is going around doing that audit, and most merchants are way out of line, so it's too many to tell off, in fact. So they're expected to move towards compliance this year, but next year they'll be expected to be moving towards compliance, and in 2011 they're expected to achieve compliance and have some damn good excuse as to why not. And so I think 2012 we should be there. All I can advise you is look at your bank statement. You know, if somebody does misuse, get your card number or your PIN and misuse it, it will be on your statement. So check your statements, and every transaction you should recognise and say, yeah, that was me. And frankly, if it wasn't you, you can ring the bank and say, that wasn't me, and the bank will just refund your money because it's cheaper to do that than argue with you. You're going to take somebody half a day to argue with you. That's $1,000 already. And if you keep doing it, they'll track that. But check every statement you've got and query it if it's not quite right. So as I said, the attacks are possible and they're out there. They're always out of reach, and I can't get enough money to tempt me into acting dishonestly with what with everything in place in my life. So those poor llamas still beckoning are still out there, unloved by me. But there they are, a pair of llamas. Okie doke. Well, I can take questions, and I'll hang around afterwards, sir, and talk to people if you wish. So there's a microphone roving. All totally blinded.
As far as the encryption goes, they can keep ramping it up. Yeah. Like you said, 4096, can go higher and higher. But it seems like quite often when, credit card number theft and often like that, it's usually they go in through a more, social engineering way. Like the credit card skimmers, they would attach to, ATM machines, or like one web design company, yeah, I worked for, they simply, put default passwords on the SQL databases and never flush the credit card numbers.
Yeah, that's a good point.
I mean, they're more than just, beefing up the encryption itself. I mean...
Well, the encryption has to be out of reach, but yeah, he's right. There are better attacks on credit card numbers. You apply a false front to the card reader on ATM. This is being done all over the world at the moment, and they're making jiggly readers to stop it. But yeah, there are easier attacks on the protocol, and it turns out it's actually never worth attacking the encryption. It's always worth attacking something else around it. So to get credit card numbers, it's easy just to get them directly, by mishandling the card or copying it. There have been PIN pads found with extra readers implanted in them, which is quite serious.
Stephen, you've talked a lot about ATM security, and from what I found over here, America runs on checks. Handwritten checks, and all you need is the account number, and you can transfer money out of that person's account.
In fact, I was covering FPOS as well. My field was FPOS, which is where you do it in a shop, and all that ATM stuff is true of FPOS as well. But there's a whole world of checks, and we don't use them much in Australia because they're intensive to handle, but they're common here. Well, up to a certain value, the bank won't bother verifying a check. It's actually $25,000 in Australia. But they will not check your signature if your check is below 25 grand. So you can write checks and send them in, and the bank will just pass them through. It's actually not worth the bother to check them because there's so many. But yeah, there are attacks on forged checks or falsifying checks and so on. This is actually covered by the field of document security, which is a much older field, hundreds of years old, and real signatures. But there are attacks on that. I've actually seen the check processing centre of my bank, and the checks come in during the day and they're processed at night. There's four big banks, and they arrive in these centres about midnight. They all come to certain locations, and these centres employ women with shopping carts. I don't know if you've seen the Stepford Wives, but it's that. These women walk around with shopping carts that are full of checks, around this place in a sort of trance, because it's 2 o'clock in the morning and they're not paid very well, and they're trundling around. They dump these checks into machines that orient them and then read them. And they read them like the old Fortran card, the old 80-column card readers. So you put like 4 feet of checks, and that's 4 feet stacked in, on edge, into this card reader. And the reader sort of goes like that. And the amount just racks up to, $4 million as common throughout that many checks. This amount just climbs up. It reads all the checks. And they dump it into the shopping cart again. And it sorts out all the checks for the various banks. And then it would pile the checks that belong to other banks. And these guys meet about 5 a.m. The four guys meet over a coffee somewhere and say, well, look, I've got checks for your bank. I've got, $438 million that I owe you, but you owe me $502 million, and so on. They agree on all this. There's this bizarre nether world of check processing. It's quite uncanny. But checks are so expensive to process that banks are charging heavily for the use of them. So I think checks are doomed as a way of payment. Oh, you can do it, but it's going to cost you $2.50. That's how they do it.
In Australia, not here.
Yeah. Here, and actually in Britain, checks are common. There's a check guarantee card that guarantees a check below 50 quid. It can't bounce below 50 quid. That's good enough for most purchases. Yeah, the handling of checks, I've never really dealt with that much. It's a different world of document forging. Forging signatures goes back centuries. You know, when you sign, that's the problem with RSA and signatures. When you sign something with RSA, they display data on a computer screen, you type a password, and then you get signed with your secret key. Now, when you sign a bit of paper, you're expected to be present when you do it and to read the paper and to write on the bottom of it, and your pen will indent the paper. But with an RSA signature, you don't even have to be there. Somebody else can sign it for you. And you can plead, well, that wasn't me, somebody else signed it. They may have to use your computer, but it can still be somebody else. And then you don't really know that what you saw was what you signed. I mean, who knows what's going on in that computer? It hasn't been legally thrashed out yet, but there's a whole minefield of legal litigation about RSA signatures coming up.
Question? I apologize, I came in a little bit late, but I caught the end of your discussion. Did you cover biometrics around?
No, I didn't cover. Biometrics really good. I mean, this four-digit PIN, it's as old as the Ark. And
I have a specific question. Yeah. Have you tracked the Palm Secure device from Fujitsu, which is already deployed in Japan, and almost all the large banks are now using ATM biometric scans of your palm? Yeah. It's called Palm Secure. Are you familiar with the device?
I've done a lot of work in Japan, actually, and I've been there three times with Visa to give a lecture to tell the manufacturers, you've got to encipher the PIN numbers. They're sending PIN numbers around in the clear. And one of them said, why do we have to do that? And I said, well, somebody might steal the PIN. And they all roared with laughter and said, nobody would do that, you know, because in Japan there's hardly any crime. It was all regulated by, you know, the Yakuza, organized crime, and banks aren't really subject to it. Everybody carries a big wad of thousands of dollars of cash around with them. Yeah, so the ATM, and the ATMs were in the bank, so you had to go in the bank to use the ATM. So they only recently come onto the street. But they have got better technology. PIN numbers, four-digit PIN that you remember is as old as the hills, and we should really move to longer PINs, or there's lots of biometric, where if something that is about your body. It's the principle of two-factor authentication. It's something you know, something you have, and something you are, and two of those have to do it. So with a PIN number, you've got the card and you know the PIN number. With biometric, you've got the card and you have the hand geometry. So you put your hand in this gadget and it reads pins come down and measure parts of your hand. And this is fairly unique, and there's thumbprint scanners. Retina scanners are very good, but the customers are scared of those. They're scared of fingerprint scanners because there's a bit of misuse of that in Australia.
Now the one I'm specifically interested in, if you've exposed the use of that, it's from Fujitsu. It's called Palm Secure. It's been out since from 2006. It's just entering the U.S. space, but all the Japanese banks are already incorporating them into their ATM machines. That device actually uses the palm blood veins in your palm, which is as equivalent in terms of security as your retina, but cannot be hacked. So you have to have your palm and you have to have blood flowing, so you cannot have bone of the screen.
Okay, yeah, that'd be very good. You've got a big palm to work from, and you clap it on some plate. Well, that'd be a very good way to go, because that's hard to forge. There's stories about fingers being cut off and so on. But, you know, really biometrics are the way forward, but then the reality is if a bank has 8,000 ATMs, they have to buy 8,000 biometric devices, which cost $8 million, and you know, the banks are quite tight with their money, so it's easier to just stick with four-digit PINs if they can get away with that. Another question?
Have you seen many banks moving towards like a tokenization of the credit of the whole card, where you instead have like an old RSA key that switches every 60 seconds that you have to have, that, you know, there's a like a clearinghouse for your card where you tokenize it and then the card company sends it over?
The card company will come back in a few seconds, there's a time on all the transactions. 60 seconds would be far too long. They come back within a few seconds. There is actually an attack on RSA there. There's a defense of RSA knowing where you've got to be within a certain physical distance of the terminal for the RSA key to work, because RSA would be attacked remotely. So using the finite speed of current in copper wires, you have to be within about 3 feet or 10 feet of the terminal for this transaction to work. It hasn't really caught on, but it is possible. If somebody's tapping the line and fiddling with the keys, they'd be doing it remotely and there'd be a too long a delay. But the credit card companies come back. They also stand in on PIN numbers. So if you enter your PIN and the bank's SCM is down, then Visa can actually stand in, or if they've been appointed to do that, they're capable of doing it. The PIN goes off to California, gets verified by Visa and comes back if the local bank can't do it. Well, I think we can wind it up there if there's no more, but I'll stick around for a few minutes and take questions. Thanks.